What I'm going to talk about today is an amalgam of procedures used to attack a very specific policy question. So, in fact, I'm working with practitioners routinely with this. This will be a mix of sort of practical tools and, as I think Chief Gascon said yesterday, algorithms. I'm interested in forecasting. I've been doing a lot of work in climate forecasting, and a lot of the tools that are used in that field in the physics of that can be reported. But then there's also some very interesting new developments in statistics and computer science that really kind of turn things around, I think, in our ability to forecast. So this is going to be about forecasting, and I'm going to talk about some of those tools. But anytime I start a talk on forecasting, I always start with a caveat emptor. Let me read this to you. Scientists from the RAND Corporation have created this model to illustrate how a home computer will look in the year 2004. However, the needed technology will not be economically feasible for the average home. Also, scientists readily admit that the computer will require as yet not invented technology to actually work. But 50 years from now, scientific progress is expected to solve these problems. With a teletype interface and a Fortran language, the computer will be easy to use. So, when we get in the forecasting business, we have to start with considerable humility. We get it wrong most of the time. And this, of course, is just one example. Okay, the problem that we are facing here, the practical problem, is how to take CompStat type settings and turn the use of those sorts of data, those spatial and temporal data, into true forecasting tools. We've been working with LAPD, but more recently in depth with a lot of different agencies in Philadelphia and on the East Coast. And I'll focus on the LAPD data for now because it's, in some sense, the analysis is farthest along. Using LAPD offense data, we started out as just everybody starts out. We define temporal and spatial units. For practical purposes in a CompStat-like setting, the temporal units are usually weeks because those are the intervals in which allocation decisions are often made for personnel. The temporal units turn out to be what are called reporting districts because those are the units in which police resources are organized, and very commonly the way the command structure demands. You locate these crimes in time and space, and then you sort of play the usual game. You define a response variable. Here, let's say the number of crimes, maybe burglary or assault or homicide. You throw in a bunch of predictors, including lagged values of the outcome variable in earlier times, and maybe some from adjacent reporting districts if you think the spatial correlation will help you. And then you estimate some function of x plus noise. That's the game. Function of x can be anything from a crosstab to linear regression to logistic regression to vector autoregression. I mean, all these fancy acronyms. But that's the game, basically. And then after you've got your function of x, you're kind of happy with it, then you just extrapolate it into the space or time that you care about. That's the way it's usually done. And we started out down that road. In this instance, however, there are a number of practical difficulties. Smaller spatial units than reporting districts are probably preferable for operational reasons. A reporting district you can think of as roughly like a census tract, and that's pretty heterogeneous. And some areas might be so-called crime hotspots, some might not be, and you can't allocate police officers to something that big. You generally allocate them to smaller things. So it's not a particularly useful operational unit. It is the way the LAPD and most major police departments organize their command structure. But in terms of efficiently allocating personnel, that's probably not what you want to do. But if you go smaller, then the crime events become quite rare. And serious crime events are rarer still. You're talking about a couple a week. It's hard to do much with that little bit of information. It also turns out that the way crimes are reported, these come from official police offense forms, the way the crimes are reported often don't map well onto behavior. Cops are dispatched at a particular call. The dispatcher gives it a name, domestic violence. Police arrive. They can see all sorts of things going on, and they give it a label. The connection between the label and what actually happened is pretty loose, particularly since a lot of the labels that are used in the actual data make the distinction between, for example, aggravated assault and assault, and who the hell knows? So that's another difficulty with these sorts of data. You all know, of course, that many kinds of crimes are grossly underreported, so again, you're dealing with a lot of censored data. And this last one maybe isn't as appreciated as widely, but it's critically important when you work in these kinds of problems, which is that the signal is very weak. Let me give you a homicide as an example. Some kid decides to carry a gun. He's got a gun, access to a gun, walks down the street. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, get into a dispute with somebody he knows. Maybe he does or maybe he doesn't take out the gun. Maybe he does or maybe he doesn't pull the trigger. Maybe he hits something. Maybe he hits the target. Maybe he hits a vital organ, maybe he doesn't. If he doesn't hit a vital organ, you're not going to have a homicide. Then it's a matter of how fast the paramedics get there and what kind of tools they have. And then it's a matter of how crowded the emergency room is when the kid gets there and what skill the doctor has. So the connection between the original behavior and the actual outcome that's recorded, a homicide, is mitigated by all kinds of chance processes. So not surprisingly, the things that might be driving the behavior are very, very loosely connected to the offense category at the end. It means the signal is very weak. And you can work these things out in probabilistic terms just from the link between a shooting and a homicide. And only about 10% of the shootings wind up in homicides or less. And so it's a very stochastically driven process. And therefore, when you try to understand what's driving homicides, you're really at a disadvantage. Okay. So let me give you an illustration. Let's look at burglaries. I pick burglaries because they're common. So it gives us a little bit of information to work out. Let's look at three separate reporting districts. I pick them because there's a lot of burglaries there and because they're adjacent and we're all concerned about the spatial dependence that might be going on. In this particular case, I have 39 weeks of data. I have 5 years worth of data. I get millions of observations. But I aggregated these up to the week and just took part of 2005, just so that I could have something I could display easily. And these aggregations to the week and to the reporting district, as I said, are based on the operational needs and CompStat-type settings. And the question is, burglaries are pretty common. These are high burglary areas. Can we see anything? Just start there before we start function estimation. Can we see anything? This is reporting district A. The vertical axis is the number of burglaries per week. You got up to 39 weeks. The blue line is simply an interpolation between the data points. The red line is a linear fit. The black line is a low S smooth. Well, maybe there's something going on there, maybe there's not. There's a slight upward trend, but gee, the difference between 1.2 and 2.2 burglaries per week is not something that's going to excite police commanders. The cyclical patterns are not regular. You can use the usual diagnostic tools. And, you know, maybe there's something there, maybe not. And the fact of the matter is, if you take this, these data and test the null, essentially that nothing is going on, the weight of the evidence against the null is not strong. So you can reorganize these data as a Poisson control chart. And the mean equals the variance. So that's kind of Poisson-like. And you get one out-of-bounds observation. But the point is you only get one and they're not next to each other. So even if you see a point that you're prepared to take as something real, systematic, doesn't help you much because if you look at the next couple weeks, it's low. But not real low. This is Poisson. Okay, here's another reporting district right next door. I mean, the borders are adjacent. Now there's a slight downward trend. Same kind of game. There are some cycles in there, but they're not regular. Again, if you do any of the kind of usual tests, the evidence against the null is pretty weak. And in fact, if you just assume it's Poisson and apply another control chart, you get kind of the same story. You get one out of bounds. And doesn't look like there's much you can use for forecasting. You need some sequences of high or low, particularly high if you're a commander, events, and it's not there. Let's take the third one. Same story, nothing new. Again, the evidence against the null is not strong. You can throw it into a control chart. This has a little more cyclical regularity. These are all adjacent reporting districts. But if you use the usual diagnostics, the signal is not real strong. So what do we get out of this? This is sort of a conventional way of going. Yeah, you can slap a Poisson regression on it or something if that's what strikes your fancy. But there's not much on which to draw. Okay, what does it tell you? Well, the mean and the variance are about the same in all three reporting districts. In fact, you can collapse them. The mean equals the variance. Proceed as if it's Poisson. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's not totally out of bounds. There's not much forecasting help because high crime days, weeks are not followed necessarily very much by high crime weeks. And it looks like, in fact, what happens with the LAPD and the Philadelphia Police Department is very common when they respond to those spikes or things that look like spikes, they're responding to noise. But they have the good fortune of being successful because if you count on regression to the mean, you see a spike, you respond to it, and then, of course, is the next week it's not going to be as high, and on the average you're right and you're a hero. So there's this funny situation going on where it looks like police allocations are often responding to noise, but nevertheless, they come out looking good because of regression to the mean. Doesn't help us much in forecasting. And that's not to say there's nothing going on, but what's going on is, from a substantive point of view, pretty obvious. There are, if you go to the spatial variation, you know, there's large differences in LA between Sherman Oaks and South Central, and everybody knows that, and the cops know it, and there's really no news. That helps you forecast in a sense, but not on a week-to-week basis. Now, if you aggregate to the city as a whole, there are some temporal patterns too. Yeah, Fridays and Saturdays are worse for assaults. Everybody knows that, cops know that. They already allocate on that basis. The statistics look very snazzy, you can fit and things look right, but it's not of any operational help. The bottom line is, at this point, we don't have much to tell the LAPD they don't already know, with the possible exception of this capitalizing on chance. And so while we're exploring getting additional predictors, and we're quite optimistic that we'll do better, weather is an obvious one, but whether, for example, there's a high school in a reporting district and therefore burglaries go up after 3 o'clock on weekdays, things like that, we'll get that information. But while that's going on, we're trying something different. Another way. What we really want to do, it sounds kind of like Minority Report, you know, the Tom Cruise movie, what we really want to do is we want to forecast in time and space crimes that haven't been committed yet. That's really what the enterprise is. Suppose we could forecast which individuals are at high risk to various kinds of crimes. Suppose we could do that well. Suppose we could locate them in time and space, because it's common for people to commit their crimes where they live and against people in their neighborhoods, and then aggregate that information up to get a better forecast of crime events. And suppose we could do that week to week as the flow of people enter and exit particular neighborhoods. Well, we're trying to do something like that. Let me tell you what we're doing in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, in the past a couple of years, the homicide rate's been increasing. We're starting to catch up to LA. We've had about 20% increase, and it looks like it's not noise, but it's hard to tell. This has generated an enormous firestorm in the political arena, a lot of finger pointing. So there's a lot of interest in pursuing means to reduce homicides, and that's how kind of we got dragged into this. Now, an interesting fact in Philadelphia, and I suspect it's true more widely, is that about a third of all homicides are committed by individuals who are in the city on probation or parole. Third of 400 is a big number. The question is, could we, using that population of individuals, provide services via probation or parole which might reduce homicides? Maybe yes, maybe no. But to do that, the first thing you got to do is forecast who the high-risk individuals are. Now, there's lots of lore out there on who the high-risk individuals are. In L.A., you look for gang tattoos. But the question is, can we do better than standard clinical lore that the police department's already using? If we can do this, we can help the police improve their CompStat forecast by taking into account the mix of individuals that are moving in and out of neighborhoods. And the bottom is, we're also looking at a way of providing these names to homicide detectives. If a homicide comes down in a particular neighborhood, they need a list of the usual suspects. They have that, but insofar as we can forecast better than their clinical knowledge, we can maybe provide a better list. Okay. To be more specific, we're looking at probation and parole. The outcome is whether there's a homicide or attempted homicide within 2 years after being assigned to a probation officer. In Philadelphia, probation and parole are collapsed. It's in the same organization. About 1% of the individuals currently under supervision will commit this crime within 2 years. Question is, which of the 100? Which one of the 100? As a technical problem, that eliminates most conventional statistical procedures because you've got a 99-1 split on the response. You can slap regression on this and you go nowhere. I mean, the problem is that I can forecast with 99% accuracy just by assuming that nobody ever pulls the trigger. So to improve on that, my statistical tools have to be somewhat unconventional. The predictors come from routine administrative data. We're working very hard on getting access to additional information, like from Children and from Family Services, which will give us information on the person's household when growing up, and information of how they performed in prison. Right now, all we have is what the parole or probation officer has when the case comes in the front door, but it's there, and we have access to it. We're going to apply statistical learning procedures. I'm going to talk a little bit more about those. They use the A word, algorithm. I'll give you a sort of a brief overview of the perspective on that. It's kind of what I do. That's the statistics I work on. I think it's neat stuff. It's not a cure-all, but I think it's an additional new tool. What we care about is forecasting skill. I don't care how well I fit the data. I don't care if it tells a plausible story. I want to forecast accurately. That's the game. And insofar as my models forecast well, I'm happy. Insofar as my forecasts don't forecast well, I'm sad. And I'm not worried about too much else. But that's the gold standard in this sort of enterprise. A key feature of that, however, is that you can't calibrate forecasting error until you take into account the costs of making mistakes. These models, all models are going to make mistakes. So the question is, what are the costs, the consequences of false positives versus false negatives? If I label a kid as high risk and he isn't, what are the consequences? If I fail to label a kid as high risk and he is, what are the consequences? That's got to be built. And otherwise, talking about forecasting error per se is not necessarily the way to go. This emphasizes the approach I would just mention about forecasting error. It's black box modeling, it's algorithmic, and we don't make any apologies about it. That's not quite true. If we apologize, it's because we don't forecast well. But we can run these models against conventional models, and under the circumstances that are in these data, it's no contest. And we don't know what's going on. Now, it'll turn out that I'll give you some output which is consistent with what criminologists normally think anyway. And that's sort of comforting. But it isn't built into the model. Whatever the algorithm gives us, that's what we go with. There are lots of algorithms out there in statistical learning. This is one I like. I'm going to have to go through it pretty quickly. There's a lot of detail in here. For those of you who know some of this, it'll be pretty apparent what's going on. For those of you who have not seen this before, I apologize. We just go back to the previous picture. Okay, random forest. You got a data set. You take a random sample, the same size as the data set. I have 1,000 observations. I take a sample of 1,000. But I sample with replacement. Okay? Because I sampled with replacement, about a third of the observations are not going to appear in my training data set, my sample. Okay? And I'll have triplicates, some duplicates, and so on in the data. That's okay. Probability sample. Then I take a random sample of predictors without replacement. I have, let's say, 300 predictors. I take a random sample of 5. I then start my classification regression trees procedure, and the first partition is based on only those 5 predictors that I randomly select. It picks the best one the way CART would normally do it. And then I repeat steps 2 through 4 for my first tree. Then I have a classification, or in this case, a classification tree, one of them. I have, as you recall, however, about a third of my data that wasn't used to build the tree. That's a true test sample. I have a validation sample built into my design. I forecast or classify, whichever either term works. I classify that test sample, but because I didn't use them to build the tree, I'm forecasting into new data, legitimately. I store whatever those classifications are. You know, Joe is a high risk, Pete's a low risk, from that single tree. Now I build a forest. I do that 1 through 5, 500 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times, a lot of times. I have a bunch of trees. Each tree is built on a new random sample of the data, and each split in each CART partition is built on a new random sample of predictors. What do I do with these trees? I hold an election. I have for Joe every time Joe was in the test sample. I count the number of times Joe was classified as high risk over 1,000 trees, let's say. If the majority says high risk, Joe is high risk. If the majority says low risk, Joe is low risk. And I do that for each and every person in my sample. That gives me a classification, okay? That's random forest. Now, there's a lot going on here. Let me just tell you what some of the assets are, and we could go into gradient boosting or a lot of the other tools, and there are some interesting differences between them, but I want to stop. I'm going to stay with this for now.
Yeah. Just a quick question. You had, for your test set, you actually had the, do you have the VAP, I mean, do you have a label?
Sure. I have 1,000 individuals. I don't know if they killed somebody or not.
Okay.
I randomly sampled with replacement. Approximately 700 go in my test sample, my training sample. 300 go in my test sample. I know the outcome.
But your outcome from the tree, that doesn't, I mean, that's not using labels from the test, is that?
The test, no, okay. I've got, just think of it as a validation sample.
Okay.
I've got two random samples from the same population. I build a model on one, but I only classify the test to take seriously. So when I classify an individual at the end of the day, I classify based on data that was not used to build the tree, which forecasts that individual's outcome. And then I average over the trees in which that individual was not a member of the set. Yeah. Okay, some assets. All the sampling frou-frou that's going on, that really helps to cut back on overfitting. We all know that you can fit a data sooner or later, and we're all creative enough to explain it very intelligently and persuasively afterwards. And if you looked at the graph upside down by mistake, you can explain it when you put it right side up. We're all very clever. So this is a way of sort of protecting yourself significantly against overfitting, which is, of course, a common issue. There's effectively no limit on the number of predictors. I can have more predictors than observations because I sample predictors at each CART partition. So I can have 1,000 predictors and 500 observations, no problem. I can effectively attack the curse of dimensionality because I'm sampling predictors. In other words, if I have 100 predictors, I'm trying to locate my data in 100 space. I'm going to have sparse data unless I've got millions and millions of observations. By sampling predictors, I work with subsets of that space at random, and that helps cut down the sparse data problem. You'll see that I inductively arrive at that function of x I talked about a little while ago. I don't impose any function. No, there was no functional forms in here. CART is sort of blind in this application to what the functional forms should be. And so if they're nonlinear, I can find them, even if I don't know what they are when I started. It also, by this sampling mechanism, allows for particular predictors, which might be pushed aside by more powerful predictors, if forced to compete head-to-head in the model, gives them a chance to shine. So predictors which normally would be ignored because they only speak to a small area of the design space, I can include because they're not competing against some of the big guys some of the time. So that's also a nice feature. I can find extremely nonlinear relationships, in fact, even step functions. I'm not limited to the usual smoother assumptions about the derivatives being the same at breakpoints and so on. I can just go with whatever the data say. And I can allow for asymmetric costs. That's real important because if you talk to the stakeholders in this area, false negatives are particularly painful. Those are individuals who shoot who you missed, well, who you failed to identify. They don't miss, let's say. That's a particularly painful consequence. Having somebody labeled as high risk and delivering extra services to them is costly to be sure, but as a political matter, it's much less than having a homicide go down for someone that you didn't know was likely to be a shooter. All this, all these assets can be woven in. Yes?
And just to see if I understand it, so there are two things going on. One is the black box, which sounds a little bit like a genetic algorithm, sometimes thing of predictors, of pooled predictors, and you've got to score them in some way. And the other part of the problem is how you're chopping up the data to do in-sample and out-of-sample.
They're really blended. They're not separate.
Right.
They're integrated.
Score that. But is that just on the black box part of it, the genetic? I mean, what sense
It's black box in the sense that you have 1,000 CART trees and you average over them. Each CART tree is not a black box. You can put a tree diagram. If I have 1,000 trees, what am I going to do?
But is it similar to, genetic algorithm, where I've got competing predictors in some sense, and I'm...
Yeah, but there's lots of genetic algorithms. I don't know which one you mean.
No, I just meant in
Well, there's a loss function here. I'm using the CART loss function, so I get the optimal split. I get the optimal split by the loss function as I build a tree. Each tree is based on a set of optimal splits. And then I average across trees because those optimal splits are significantly determined by chance. And so by averaging, I cancel out that overfitting that occurs.
But is it a winner-takes-all type thing?
Well, we vote. In that sense, it's winner-takes-all.
Yeah.
But again, the vote is mediated by the cost. So I gave you the simple example of a majority vote, but if we put putting in costs, we may require a supermajority, two-thirds, depending upon the cost. Okay, the data come from Philadelphia, entering cohorts 2002. We have a two-year follow-up. In this case, there's about 67,000 cases, hundreds of potential predictors. In this particular case, 1.1%, 739 cases, committed a homicide or attempted homicide, almost all by shooting, by firearms. Just because I don't need more data and I'm working on a laptop sometime. I use 30,000 observations and 30 predictors. The 30 predictors I use are kind of obvious ones. Criminologists who work in this area would say, oh yes, use this, use this, use this, use this, and we use them. And then we use some others as well. But this, for purposes of this illustration, I just use 30. It makes no difference. We've tried them with lots more and lots of different ones. And we're going to use roughly a 1 to 10 cost ratio of false positives to false negatives. Consistent with what I was saying before, you fail to find a shooter is much more expensive than falsely finding a shooter. That's just a policy decision. It's not a statistical decision. It's not a scientific decision. It is a policy decision. And the 1 to 10 ratio comes from various stakeholders. Now, stakeholders don't all agree. That's a political problem. And we can talk about how you arrive at these costs. But for this analysis, 1 to 10 was what we used. I should say that if you don't specify costs, you really are specifying costs. You're assuming 1 to 1. And for a policy purpose, that's usually not what you want to do. If you look at most important policy outcomes, they're asymmetric costs. You got to build that into the forecast.
Question.
Yeah.
Are you using those costs on the final outcome, or are you weighting each?
They go back to the CART algorithm. You can put them in with priors, or you can put them in. In this case, we do it with the way we sample. We oversample.
So each observation gets the.
You go back to the very top. You don't at the end put a new threshold on, although you can. There's technical reasons why you want to go back at the very beginning of the procedure and put the costs in there. That's what we do, just like you can in CART. Okay, how well do we do? Without worrying about waiting for a moment, the overall forecasting skill is 93% right, but of course that's trivial. I could be 99% right if I always say no one's a shooter. Among the individuals who are not shooters, I'm 94% accurate, so I give up something there. That's the trade-off of false positives and false negatives. But I'm 46% accurate on the true positives. Of all the true positives, my model identifies them correctly about half the time. That's pretty good, considering I started with 1 in 100. But I do build in this cost ratio of 1 to 10. Okay? Whether you like that, I'm not sure I'm happy with it, but it's not my call. It comes from the individuals who are going to use this stuff. And in practice, what this means, out of every 100 individuals who come in the front door, probation and parole, about 10% are classified as high risk. Okay, we've already started talking about false positives. Just a couple of other observations. They're inevitable. You can trade them against false negatives. You don't have to settle for a certain number of false positives, but you always are making this trade. If you increase, if you make it more and more difficult for someone to be a false positive, you're encouraging false negatives. And there's no way out of that. That's just the way it's an inevitable zero-sum game. One of the things that affects how you think about false positives is the kind of interventions employed. We're using what we think is kinder and gentler services so that the high-risk individuals who are subject to much more intensive parole supervision, caseloads of 15 rather than 150, they get help with literacy, they get medical help, they get psychiatric help, and a variety of other services like job training. I'm not designing those. These are things that a lot of folks have thought would be helpful, and they are assembled from different agencies and made available to the probation and parole officers for these caseloads of 15. I don't know if they're going to work or not. We're in the midst of a randomized clinical trial trying that. So we select the high-risk offenders, and we put them through this randomized clinical trial, and I'll let you know in 2 years. If it's helpful. The other thing we're doing, though, which is kind of cute, is that we're trying to net shrink. The complaint here is, oh my goodness, we're net widening once again. You're going to have 10 false bad guys for every true bad guy. We're also in the process of developing a model in which we look at the low-risk individuals. The guess is about 75% of the caseload are no threat to the public at large. If we can identify those, we might go to a system like New York has, with we report to a kiosk and give a palm print, and that's your reporting to your probation officer. That's still being developed. But the goal is to also take out the low-risk folks as a resource allocation problem so that the folks who are currently chewing up resources who don't need them, free of those resources so the high-risk individuals have access to them. But nevertheless, it's a political problem. And how this is going to ultimately shake down is not clear. Okay, what do the random forests give us? Well, on the left side are the predictors that we use in this model. It's small, I'll read them to you. Criminologists will say, sure, and yeah. Is it a firearm case? Is the incident case firearm case, a drug case? Size of the black population in the zip code where the person's from? Population in the zip code, income in the zip code? Whether a zip code is reported at all, whether there's a residence for that person? Whether the incident case was a violent case? Age of first contact, that's the first time this person's name pops up in the records of the local courts. These are adult. Well, they're often underage as adults, but they're treated as adults. So like 16 is about as young as it gets. We're going after juvenile records, though, that'll help. FTAs are failure to appear in court when required. Whether there's a prior incarceration, prior jail term. Whether they're the number of violent priors, the number of total priors, age, young people are bad. Race and gender. Young males are bad. Shooters are mostly young males. I mean, again, criminologists have known this, for 100 years? There's nothing new in the predictors that are found here, but there is some things new in what they show. Anyway, these numbers on the horizontal axis are the increase in forecasting error if that particular variable is not allowed to assist in the forecasting enterprise. So, for example, if you do not allow age to improve your forecasts, your forecasting error increases by about 12%. Let's say from your 50% right, you drop to 38% right. It's a big drop. And it turns out there's only three or four variables in this model that really make a lot of difference in your forecasting skill one by one. Age at first arrest, gender. And then depending upon how you want to weigh things, race might make a difference, violent priors might make a difference, size of the black population might make a difference. But they're definitely second-order predictors. Again, criminologists know this. Okay, so the story here is not about the predictors found. What we're able to do is squeeze a lot more information out of these predictors than has historically been the case. There's no new sort of qualitative findings. Oh my goodness, men are more dangerous. What we're doing, though, is we're taking that same set of predictors and extracting a ton more information than previously had been possible. Let me show you what we call partial response plots. The vertical axis you can think of loosely at this point as logits. The horizontal axis is values of the predictor I'm going to show you a few. This is sort of the functional form relating the odds that someone is a shooter against age. And if you compare the individuals who are 30 years old to those who are 18, the 18-year-olds have twice the odds of being a shooter, okay? But the big drop is early. So young kids, 17, 18, 19, are really significantly more risky than 22, 23, 24. And after the age of 30, you don't care. Okay? Highly nonlinear, almost step function, but highly nonlinear. If you put a straight line through that, like you would in logistic regression, you're going to miss a big chunk of the story. Response to age of first contact. Same kind of thing. Individuals whose contacts are at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 are a ton worse than individuals whose first contacts are in their early 20s. Okay? There's an increase here at the end. There's not a lot of data out here, so I wouldn't take that all that seriously, but we think those are DV cases. But for the vast majority of street crimes, again, we're talking about doubling the odds that someone is a shooter if you compare a 16-year-old to a 23-year-old. Big difference. After that, it doesn't matter. You put a straight line through that, you miss a big chunk of the story. Number of priors. Again, there's an enormous difference between none and a few, and then it levels off. Now, I should say the number of priors here is very large because these are charges. So one crime event may lead to 15 charges. And those are 15 priors if there are convictions on those. So we don't have many people out here. But there are some individuals with 100 priors, you know, 40 years old, and they've done 10, 15 crimes, each of which involve 5, 6 to 10 charges, and it adds up. But most of the folks are down in the 20s and 30s, and in that range at least, that's a very strong relationship. But again, you about double the odds. If you compare somebody with no violent priors to somebody with, let's say, 10 or 12 or 15, you double the odds the person's a shooter. did that. Total number of priors is more sort of conventionally linear. More priors in general, not just violent priors, it increases the odds. The difference between somebody with none and a lot is to multiply the odds that you're a shooter by about 1.3. Size of the African-American population in the zip code. This surprised us. You again have a strongly nonlinear relationship, kind of S-shaped function. It says that up to about 20,000 it doesn't matter, and over about 60,000 it doesn't matter. But in that interval, you get a rapid increase. We don't know what that's about. That's holding constant, by the way, proportion black and things like that. This is just sheer numbers. Our hunch is this may be something epidemiological. I mean, obviously, if you people kill people like themselves, the larger the black population, the more potential shooters, the more potential victims, but we don't know. This turns out to be not that powerful a predictor anyway. It only multiplies the odds by about 1.25 if you compare zip codes with 20,000 to zip codes with 60,000, but it's in there. And it's also going to create some political problems. We're not quite sure what we're going to do about that yet either. Okay, at the end of the day, what do we got? If you look at the pool of offenders, when you start this analysis, as I said, 1 in 100 is a shooter. If you look at our pool of high-risk offenders, 1 in 10 is a shooter. So we're 10 times better off, loosely speaking. We're doing substantially better. And the statistical point, and the main statistical point now, is to sort of emphasize that, again, while the predictors are no news, squeezing out additional information that's conventionally been available, particularly working with highly nonlinear relationships, really dramatically improve forecasting skill. If you apply conventional logistic regression to this, or whatever your standard tool is that opposes a functional form, let's say linear in the log of the odds, you go nowhere. Doesn't help you much. What's next? I've already refined the model beyond what's here. We continually update our data to get better predictors. It took a little convincing, but now the parole probation is on board, and basically they're opening all their records to us, and so we're getting information we need that we didn't have when I built these models. They'll do better. We're in a position where we can update the models very quickly. The code I wrote is pretty much sitting there. I can just throw in new things as I need. It's not a ton of work. We've got our first cohort of high-risk cases entering our randomized clinical trial. I should tell you, the reason why is accidental. It's like warm days, an unusually warm summer that convinces people global warming is here. Just fooling around with this, I gave them the first 5 cases over the summer. Out of the first 5 cases, within 2 weeks, 1 was dead, 2 were shooters, and 1 was arrested for an assault. There was 1 left on the street. Now, that's just happenstance. But they said, wow. And since that time, they've been extremely cooperative. And this has to go through the judges and police and all kinds of others. So we've got people on board, thanks to this happenstance, bad fortune for the individuals, but good fortune for the model. I don't take any credit for hitting 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5 in the first 2 weeks, but it was obviously an important experience for them. So we got this a randomized clinical trial underway. 2 years from now, we'll know if the intervention is any good. But right now, I'm more interested in whether we can forecast well. What we're also doing, and we're in the process now of week to week, as new individuals come into the system and leave the system, we forecast who the high-risk individuals are, who the shooters are likely to be, and allocate them to neighborhoods. So the neighborhood risk varies from week to week, depending on who's there then. Now, the cops already use some of this information in L.A. They know when some very visible gang members are returning, but they have no quantitative understanding of how many people with what kinds of backgrounds are showing up in reporting districts. In Philadelphia, they don't either, but we're hoping to help them. This will be an additional piece of information that will be entered into the CompStat procedure so that not only do they have these time series cross-section data sets, but they said, uh-oh, I have a big, big slug of troublemakers coming in this next week or two, and it may guide the allocation of resources. We're also moving towards cooperating with DA and homicide detectives. If a shooting goes down, I don't know what the clearance rate is where you live. In LA, the clearance rate for homicides is about 30-40%. In Philadelphia, it's about 20%. This is with a large number of homicides. So the police are very anxious for any kind of information. You know, a lot of these shootings involve kids. They're impulsive shootings. It's very, very hard to find witnesses at all, let alone witnesses that will cooperate. These are tough cases to solve. So insofar as we can give them some names to start with, maybe it'll help. Don't know if it will. We're just starting those negotiations. And well on our way to developing a low-risk model to pull out of the pool individuals who don't need these intensive services and go to the New York City model, as I said, where they just report to a kiosk and give them a handprint. And that seems to be quite successful, although I haven't seen a formal evaluation of that yet. And that's where we are.